and welcome to the Wobcast, where we chat with IWW members about organizing, solidarity, unionism, and whatever else comes up. If you're wondering what I mean when I say solidarity unionism, I invite you to listen to the first episode, not the standard playbook. Today, I have the pleasure of talking with Katya Roskov, who I'm lucky to call a friend, and who's also a longtime Wobbly, an experienced organizer, an amazing teacher, and now has won awards for her teaching. Congratulations.
Thank you.
And a solid gold dancer to boot. Welcome to the Wobcast, Katya.
Thank you.
So, I hope we're going to touch on a whole bunch of different topics. But one of the things that I want to start off with is kind of jumping into reproductive labor. And I know that one of the things that you've said really bugs you about your job, or is about the way that people talk to you about your job, or the assumptions that they make, is they say, oh, you're a preschool teacher. Oh, it must be so nice to just cuddle kids all day or just play with kids. And I think that that's a really good example of these kinds of assumptions that we make about reproductive labor, which maybe I could ask you to define that.
Sure.
And then comment on this, this idea that reproductive labor is inherently unskilled.
Right. Totally. So first of all, that's one of my least favorite things that people say about my job, because there's a lot of different skill that goes into the type of work that I do. But there's also a lot of different skill that goes into the type of work that women do when they're raising kids outside of a professional context. So I do it. I'm a preschool teacher, and I do parent coaching as a part of my work as well. So I see that work in context, which is waged, so my job, and I also see people doing that same work in an unwaged context at home when they're raising their own kids. So I hate when people say that about that type of work, because otherwise, what am I, and what is everybody who's working with children doing all day if it's not skilled work? I mean, I work with children with special needs, and the difficulties that are involved in doing very simple things like feeding or toileting or, you know, getting kids to bed. Any parent knows, whether your child has special needs or not, that is a lot of work and that it is not easy work, and that it does not always, you know, just kind of come naturally to us. So you had asked me also to define reproductive labor, and I am going to do a probably terrible job of it. But reproductive labor is all of the labor that is done to reproduce the workforce in capitalism. So that can be having children in the literal sense of giving birth to children, but it also involves raising children, raising workers. And it also involves the things that we do to ensure that people are able to show up for their jobs on a daily basis. So things like, you know, being nice to people after they get home from work and feeding them a dinner so that they're able to, you know, nourish their bodies and be able to show up for that wage labor that they go to work for every day.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And so, I mean, parenting is a kind of reproductive labor. There are other kinds of reproductive labors as well. And my job itself, I'm not sure whether or not you could call it reproductive labor. I mean, it is in a sense, but it's also waged. Most reproductive labor is unwaged.
Right. Yeah. I mean, there's a whole bunch of different, you know, directions to go.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I mean, that's kind of the idea, as I understand it. Again, I don't have an academic understanding of the term reproductive labor, but it's sort of, like you said, everything that all of the work that is necessary to, you know, make it so that people can go to work, and enough people, and especially, you know, so cooking, cleaning, caregiving.
Absolutely.
You know, and I think it also, in my understanding, includes things like elder care,
mm-hmm.
right? Even though that's not, you know, it might be taking care of people who are, you know, no longer in the workforce, but are sort of, it's part of this kind of like, you know, the social infrastructure, almost like all of the work that goes into just maintaining kind of basic social cohesion.
Absolutely. You can't go to work if you have to stay home and care for your mom who's elderly. But if, you know, you have a partner or somebody who's doing that work for you, then that frees you up to be able to go out and make a wage. And also reproductive labor also just literally includes making new members of the workforce by reproduction. So, and so it's, you know, it's kind of, it's twofold. It's reproducing people's ability to go to work on a daily basis and reproducing them as workers. And it's also literally reproducing workers.
Right. Raising children that are going to
become
enter the workforce at some point. So I guess, you know, the what I really want to get into, and it's kind of hard to do, I guess, or maybe that's just hard for me, is thinking about, okay, well, it, you know, this podcast is about organizing, mm-hmm. right? And it's about solidarity unionism. And so, you know, what is the relationship between organizing and reproductive labor? And that's not really a question. That's just kind of like what I sort of want to get into in the various ways, unless you have an answer.
I definitely don't have an answer to that question. I think there are many answers to that question. And I think that it's not really for us as organizers to say these are the answers to the question and these are not the answers to that question. It is about people's personal relationships with the type of work that they do. And that's very complicated when we're talking about reproductive labor, because people, it's not as likely to be an, you're not as likely to have an abstracted, alienated relationship from that work. If you are caring for your baby and you're putting your kid down to sleep, or you're, you know, giving your partner a back rub because they've been on their feet all day, we have feelings about that work. And so it's not as easy to kind of take ourselves out of the equation and say, how does this just operate as a, you know, systemic kind of thing?
Yeah. So maybe let's follow that path for now, right?
Sure.
Let's maybe just separate out the unwaged reproductive work. Cause mm-hmm. at some point I want to talk about stuff like teacher strikes
yeah.
and, you know, organizing, you know, waged work, you know, that is doing like your job, right?
Mm-hmm.
Reproductive labor in a waged context, right? Or work that is directly somehow related to reproductive labor. But when we're talking about reproductive labor in an unwaged context, right? So caregiving, you know, just household maintenance, you know, there's recently been, I mean, it's not a new thing, but this idea of kind of the women's strike,
right?
As like a day without a woman. And there's been various, you know, incarnations and places in the world and over the last several decades that this, a version of this has really popped up. And I am not at all an expert.
Neither am I. I've never been involved with any of that stuff. So,
right. But I think it's really interesting to kind of just get into it and pick it apart a little bit, because it's kind of this, well, what would it, you know, what does it mean to have, you know, I mean, if the idea behind, you know, even though we have to acknowledge, of course, that reproductive labor isn't only done by women,
mm-hmm.
right? Women do, you know, carry through a disproportionate amount of the especially unwaged reproductive labor that mm-hmm. happens in society. So this, you know, the women's strike is kind of, you know, it asks some pretty interesting questions, right? I mean, I think there's been some very good critiques of, you know, is it a strike?
Mm-hmm.
Is it a protest? Is it, you know, and depending on which one you're kind of talking about, but I guess it's like, how do you, you know, it's usually we talk about, you know, challenge building power on the shop floor, right? And how, I guess, do you turn that around and say, well, you know, how do you build power when there isn't that, you know, inherently conflictual, you know, in relationship between, you know, a group of workers and an employer?
I don't have the answer to that, but I think that it is a critically important question. In my mind, the women's strikes, what it does do is it's an important symbol of the significance of that type of work, which is mostly being performed by women. And so I think that the one of the things that's true of unwaged domestic labor is that it occupies a very unique spot within capitalism. It's work that is necessary to capitalism. It's work that has a value under capitalism, but it's not work that is waged. Why do people perform it? Right? And the only reason that people do perform this work is because they do have feelings about it. They have attachments to the people in their lives. And so it's a very important clue about women's relationship to capitalism because it is so unique in the way that it's situated. And so the things like the women's strike kind of point to that. I don't think that the women's strike is giving any kind of cohesive strategies or answers about how it's important or how we can use its importance. But I do think it kind of points to it and says, hey, look over here. Here's something that's really essential and we should be talking about it.
Right. Yeah. I mean, there's kind of this idea that if, you know, it's an implicit or explicit in that kind of, you know, if all the women in the whole world or even just one area, you know, withdrew their unwaged reproductive labor, you know, for enough time, the whole system would collapse.
Right.
And it's true, but it's also not really
feasible.
Yeah.
I mean, I suppose it is feasible, but people are very unlikely to do that because, you know, they're not going to say, I strike, I refuse to feed my hungry children. I think that that has always been the difficulty with the types of strikes and actions that have been associated with pointing out the importance of reproductive labor and withdrawing that labor. That's always been the wall that we come up against, is that people do this work because they love the people around them and not simply because they're getting a wage for it. And so then that makes things very difficult. Do they still have a relationship to the means of production? Yes. Are they highly motivated to not take their hands off the wheel? Yes. And so that's the difficulty with it. I don't think that that means that there aren't things that we can do. I think that it means that we need to strategize carefully and that we need to involve more people than just women potentially withdrawing their labor in those conversations about how we're going to do that, because otherwise it has detrimental impacts on the lives of women.
Right. And so what are, you know, I mean, when we think about, well, what are the kinds of things that we could be doing? I mean, when we think about the basics of organizing, right, you have mm-hmm. to have a demand and a target.
Yeah, absolutely.
So how do those, you know, how do you kind of interpret those?
I think the
components?
Specificity of the demand has always been the difficulty with this type of organizing. And in that we're not just trying to make people feel bad or guilty about the labor that women perform unwaged and often unrecognized and often invisibly. We are also trying to make strides, whether those strides are towards, you know, better funded childcare positions, or whether or not we have more staff in, you know, in facilities that care for kids, or whether or not we're receiving, you know, more money into households so that people are able to stay home with kids, or if we have more nursing stations in, you know, in public places. If we're going to make those demands, I think we have to be specific about what it is that we are asking for. And that's something that I don't think has historically been done particularly well.
Mm-hmm. It's kind of there's these disconnects between all of these sort of, you know, yeah, really kind of specific campaigns that are very, you know, kind of focused on sort of advocacy or lobbying, right? And for very, I would say, you know, worthwhile demands that are being made of the government, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But those tend to be limited by a lack of a broader analysis,
and
right? And whereas the ones that sort of have the broad analysis lack that really kind of specific demand and target and kind of sense of how you actually make kind of incremental or even big change, right? I mean, it's first step.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, withdraw our labor. third step,
right? Magic. We have a solution. And I think that one of the things that we can see in a lot of these movements is that they're very abstracted from women's actual performance of that labor. So when we're lobbying governments, the lobbying is not happening at the same level as women performing labor in their homes and communities. And that...
Well, you know, I mean, it depends on what level, right? So, you know, if I... Just to get a little bit... Give some of the... Because I think I kind of want to stay here for a minute in terms of, like, the value of you know, making specific demands of different... Of various levels of government, right? Mm-hmm. Because... Those demands, you know, for programs, you know, the basic kind of social democracy things, you know, pushing for more childcare and for better, you know, specific protection for, you know, for caregivers. Like in Alberta in the last year or couple of years, there have been some changes that I personally have benefited from. Like we have now a much more affordable childcare system in my town than we did before, and it's made a huge impact. And I push back a little bit because you're saying, well, it's not really happening at the level, but like actually in the communities in a small town like mine, right? It's the daycare workers themselves and the parents of those of the daycare and the, you know, that have been lobbying,
the loudest
that have been part of that, right? And so it is kind of cool to see that there are these sort of structures in place that have been kind of mobilizing for more, you know, really specific kinds of better programming and more support, and it's really, you know, it's expanded the program, like the childcare spaces in my town, by like threefold or something over a year, right? Mm-hmm. And it raised, you know, raising minimum wage, specific things like you know, protections for the employment law was changed in Alberta over the past couple of years. I think it was 2018 that now there's a protected day for victims of domestic abuse. So you can't legally be fired for taking days off if you're experiencing a domestic abuse situation, right?
Totally.
And so that's, you know, I mean, it's all kind of connected. And I guess I want to get your, I'm just going on a rant here. I'm supposed to be.
I think it's really cool to hear that in some communities that is operating like that. I think in my community, in the community that I teach in, I haven't seen that relationship between people making those demands and those demands happening. I very often have seen that people kind of get on the bandwagon afterwards. They're told there's going to be $25 a day subsidized daycare spots. And then people go, yeah, we wanted that.
Right.
But they weren't involved in the kind of wheels that turned to make that process happen. And
That's
especially,
fair.
I think that goes for the families who are doing the most waged labor outside the home and are not able to be part of those processes.
Absolutely.
Which is a lot of the families that I work
with.
Yeah. The other thing that I would say about it is that in the context that I work in, some of those policies have actually run up against people's motivation to organize and to mobilize. So they gave us those subsidized daycare spots. And so, if your child is receiving some of those subsidized daycare program spots, they're not able to access some other supports that people like I provide. So you might not be able to access another subsidized spot in another facility. So if you're hoping for more childcare for your child, you get daycare, but you're not going to get, say, programming for a child with special
right.
needs. And those two things cancel each other out. And so what I have heard from families is that they're really afraid to ask for more for their kids because they're worried that they're going to get pulled, that the supports that they do have are going to get pulled, and they feel like they're getting a little bit, so they've got to hold on to it.
Right. Well, and I mean, if that's, you know, to without getting into the minutiae of the Alberta, you know, childcare system,
yeah.
Like, I think there's something there, right, where it's like when we're making demands or pushing for change at the government level, right? There's always going to be that tension, right? Like the individual, you know, family that, or caregiver that is trying to get their kid into a care situation, like, what power do they have?
Exactly.
Right?
Exactly.
And so, yeah. So I guess I wanted to kind of pick up on something like in a critique, of the women's strike, or of a particular, manifesto that's connected to the women's strike. Marianne Garneau makes the argument that, quote, the terrain of struggle for reproductive labor can only be the institutions administering society, most of all the state. This is what we must target to make structural changes to reproductive labor, for example, by demanding free universal childcare programs, universal health care, yeah, et cetera, end quote. And I think that I want to pick that out apart a little bit, because I think that, yes, we do need to be making those demands. Yes, we do need to be sort of, you know, participating in protests that are, you know, actual, they're protests and not sort of strikes dressed up as, you know, or protests dressed up as strikes, rather, to make those kind of specific demands of the state. But I actually want to push back on that idea that the state is the only terrain of struggle. You know, I mean, she talks in the same article about, like, the, you know, that there's an opportunity for women to make some very specific demands, you know, about particular issues in a particular workplace, and gives the example of workers at Stardust winning the lactation room, right? And but I guess for me, it's just so much more than that. Like, it's so much more, like, you know, the raising the minimum wage is a part, right? Like, it's a situation where it's sort of, that's a demand on the government, but it also has these big implications for workers, and not just raising minimum wages, but like fighting for a wage. If you're a parent, you know, or a caregiver, you know, getting a raise at work or fighting for a raise in your waged context has a huge impact on your reproductive, the situations under which you're providing that reproductive labor.
I would broadly agree that definitely where we make changes in waged labor situations, that has a real impact on families. But I think we're talking here about, or it sounds like Marianne's talking about, the situations in which there is not a wage being provided to people, and they're doing that reproductive labor in an unwaged context. And in that case, I would say that I agree with Marianne that the state really is the only terrain of struggle, because who else could possibly be the target, unless the target is your own children or your own elderly parents or your own...
But that's, I don't think anyone's arguing that.
Exactly.
Right?
Well, but I mean, but I think that is the logical conclusion, that people are maybe not explicitly saying out loud, but is implicit in the types of arguments that are being made. I mean, who's the target? There either is no target, or the target is the people who, you know, in a classic context, we would say the boss or the person who's benefiting from our labor. And so we can't target all of capitalism at the same time.
Patriarchy.
Exactly.
Patriarchy,
and so, and we, I suppose we could target the individual representatives of the patriarchy in our homes, our husbands or partners, theoretically. I don't think most people would probably do that. And then the other target that I can think of would be the state and these state institutions. And so I think that that's why that analysis makes the most sense to me. But I totally agree that changes in waged contexts make huge impacts on families and take some level of stress off reproductive labor. I have a slightly unrelated anecdote, but I think this speaks to how stress is taken off unwaged labor by waged labor. I was going to do some childcare for a friend of mine after work, and I had a really, really busy day. And so in like 2 seconds in the Starbucks lineup, I was doing what we often do to make ourselves feel better, which was I looked up a list of like self-care activities. And so I was reading through the list, scrolling through, being like, what could I do to make myself feel like recharged for dealing with my 75th tantrum of the day? And as I was scrolling through the list, it didn't make me feel better, by the way, because what I noticed was that a lot of things on the list of self-care activities were what I would call invisible or unwaged labor. And it was like, you know, make a lovely dinner for your family and all sit down together to eat. And I was like, that isn't self-care. That's unwaged labor. Like, and so it's interesting because I think that the ways that we, that unwaged labor and reproductive labor have become so absorbed and so invisible that we can't even tell when we're performing it versus taking care of ourselves on a daily basis. And so that unwaged waged relationship is very complex.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. Well, So for someone who, you know, is entirely outside of sort of a waged labor context, which is, you know, not, mm-hmm. there are people, you know, absolutely. In that situation. Absolutely.
I know many of them. Lots of the families I serve have adult individuals who are entirely outside the wage system.
Mm-hmm. And the household is not dependent on a wage.
And I actually have some families where nobody in the household is in a wage context and they're receiving assistance from the government.
Mm-hmm. And in those circumstances, absolutely, like the only target is the state. Right. And in those circumstances, I mean, we have to be making these, you know, it's like, I mean, I'm not talking about those specific individuals, but like when we're making these, when we're thinking about these kinds of demands and we're thinking about this kind of, you know, making progress in reproductive labor in this kind of general way, if we're putting our organizing lens on it, you know, we're saying, okay, you know, when we're organizing, we're talking about building power over the long run, right? But what we're really doing is making very small demands, mm-hmm. you know? And so,
And hopefully getting them.
building the power that's necessary to win those demands, to build confidence and to, you know, and to grow slowly, or not necessarily slowly, but grow, you know, through action and through winning, not just kind of like organizing for one big, you know, existential fight. So I guess what I'm saying is like that it's important for those kinds of, you know, when we're I don't want to say organizing. I mean, mm-hmm. with those kinds of demands that were being made of the state, you know, I think that it's important for them to be kind of like both take the same kind of, you know, really basic, like what's the bigger goal, right? Like if we're thinking in an organizing context of like workers basically running the shop, you know, sort of with the state, it's thinking about things like big things like universal childcare, like a true universal, fully free, everybody gets in. It's awesome. There's none of the minutiae, like you lose something if you get it. Like it's something that really works. Like that's the equivalent kind of end goal. But to get there, we sort of have to, you know, we have to win the smaller stuff, but we can't get stuck there.
Exactly.
I think that's really what happens in the, you know, when we're kind of making demands of the state, is you get a kind of a partial solution, you know, maybe, and then it gets eroded over time.
And I mean, I think similar things happen in workplaces, mm-hmm. which is that we get partial kind of acquiescence from employers, and then those things, if the power isn't maintained,
if we don't keep pushing,
get eroded over time. So I don't think that the organizing playbook that the IWW has, in theory, I don't think it's inapplicable to reproductive labor scenarios. I think mm-hmm. that it makes a lot of sense for this type of organizing, especially because this type of unionism and organizing strategy lends itself very nicely to shifting terrain and to maintaining power in the long term and making big societal change as well.
Right.
So I think that all of those things that we do can be applied to the situations of reproductive labor. Exactly how, I'm not sure. Mm-hmm. It depends very much on the organizing conversations that people are having.
Yeah, well, I mean, to the simple answer is with a lot of door knocking and, you know, doing the same kind of, like, sort of prefigurative sort of like relationship building, you know, democratic organizing, you know, it's just that it's a slightly different, you know, the target is different and the, you know, the ways that you can make those kinds of smaller demands and, you know, over time are look different, but I agree, you know, the basics of like AEIOU talking to your neighbors, to the other families, you know, that are similar situations, like it takes time and there's no shortcuts and, you know, no one's coming.
Yeah, absolutely. And my families that I work with and families that are my personal friends, I would say from conversations with them, the big thing that we need to do if we're going to do any work in organizing reproductive labor is talk to women especially about why they are doing the work that they're doing and their individual relationships to that work. Because one of the things that capitalism has done very successfully is invisibilize women's labor by naturalizing it and situating it as inherent to the personality of that exploited person. Mm-hmm. And by doing that, we have given ourselves a bunch of narratives about why that exploitation is just the way that the world is. It's common sense. And so in order to start to undo that work, we have to be talking to women about their actual relationships to their labor. And that is very different from one person to another. Mm-hmm. I know parents who deeply resent the work that they do on a daily basis for their children. They love their children, but they do not like the work of parenting. I know parents...
I can relate. On some days, I can definitely relate.
And I think all parents can sometimes, for sure. But I also know parents who, on a daily basis, say, I didn't know that I was signing up for this mm-hmm. particular type of work. I also know parents who say, my greatest pride and joy is, you know, throwing a dinner party where I've made all organic meals for my 6 children, and then we have a family board game night afterwards. And so we need to get to the root of those conversations without all of the patriarchal judgments and the capitalist framing that we have allowed to be placed on top of unwaged labor and reproductive labor.
That's really, yeah. And I mean, when you strip it down, right, like that's what AEIOU is all about, right?
Absolutely.
You meet people where you're at, where they're at. You're in your agitate conversations. You're supposed to be really listening, right? And like, I remember at some point you talking about, you know, it being really frustrating, that like people on the left and organizers, you know, that often come from kind of lefty backgrounds, are really dismissive of a lot of sort of really, kind of feminine markers, right? Like, they sort of feel the need to want to kind of liberate, you know, women from the need to wear high heels and lipstick, right? And that in those, you know, in the context of a workplace, like if you're talking, you know, if you're kind of a lefty dude that doesn't really, you know, see the point in wearing high heels, but you happen to be talking to a worker who is wearing high heels, you can't assume that these are, you know, something that she might experience as oppressive, right?
Absolutely.
You have to really listen to where people mm-hmm. are coming from.
And as a society, we have allowed the devaluation of women's labor to be conflated with the actual value of that labor. The actual value of that labor is enormous, but the narratives that society holds about the value of that labor are, you know, it's unskilled. Women do it because we can hardly help it. You know, we're just deeply nurturing people
that's
who
like,
want to spend all our time,
yeah,
you know,
it
looking
must be
after
so
others.
Easy.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so we, and so then, you know, that's just what they do, and they're going to do it whether we pay them or we don't pay them. So just let them do it. And so we've allowed that narrative of the lack of value of women's labor to become the dominant narrative. And we need to reverse that. And we need to do that in individual organizing conversations with women talking about the value of their labor.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, I mean, meeting people where they're at, right?
Mm-hmm.
But I guess I, do you have more, like, do you have more to see? Can we pivot a little
sure,
bit?
Sure, let's pivot.
Let's pivot to talking about the kind of on an individual level, like those people who are in wage, you know, whether it's, you know, a person themselves like me, I have kids and I work a full-time job, mm-hmm. Or people who, you know, the household is dependent on a wage, even if not, you know, both partners don't necessarily work. Like, I guess I want to sort of just really, I mean, maybe it's really obvious the kind of points I want to make, but like talking about how making demands in the workplace and winning on demands and organizing for what are sort of bread and butter, like, I guess kind of coming back to sort of, you know, the tendency, and again, I'm not an academic and I don't want to, you know, really put my foot in my mouth here, but like, I really think that there's this sort of on the left, there's this, a tendency to sort of dismiss unionism as kind of its only bread and butter, right. You know, and it's like, but these are sort of, you know, these structures of exploitation, you know, that, you know, are oppressive in these specific ways. And sort of, there's this kind of real, separation between like, well, there's unions over there that do that thing, but they're, you know, unions are outdated and they're for white dudes in overalls, right? Mm-hmm. And they're no longer relevant, and you know, and it's just about bread and butter issues. And I'm like, when I come across those kinds of attitudes, whether they're sort of, you know, explicit, they're usually not that explicit, but often they are. It's kind of these, you know, well, unions are irrelevant or outdated institutions or that kind of thing. Like, part of what's implicit there is just like, it makes me want to scream, because it's like, the Canadian Union of Postal Workers won maternity leave. You know, they were the first union to win maternity leave in Canada. and that's, you know, was part of what ended up, you know, women winning maternity leave across the whole country. Like, and getting, you know, when I think about what women in the States have for maternity leave, it's abysmal. And I just like, how, I mean, I think our maternity leave situation could be extreme, you know, could be very much improved. I think it's kind of the way that it's structured, there's a lot of problems with it, but it's a hell of a lot better than what's in the States, right? And to me, those things are so connected, you know, like fighting for specific demands, whether they're, you know, a lactation room, whether they're, you know, winning paternity leave for, you know, tens of thousands of workers. I mean, winning things like sick days, right? Mm-hmm. I don't take sick days for myself. I take sick days because my kids are constantly sent home from the germ cesspool that is daycare. And my having a union job where I have flexibility, you know, I mean, it doesn't mean that I have less work to do. You know, there's other things to be said about that. But like, I don't have to worry like I did, you know, I would have. You know, I remember when I was a postal worker, like, you know, I didn't have kids when I was working at the post office, but there were lots of parents who were really like juggling very complicated childcare arrangements because of the weird shifts and because of the, you know, we had pretty good sick time, but like you got injured, you got, you know, all of these things anyway that like take us where we're sort of, I don't know what I'm saying. Like, it's just every demand that I could make as a worker is inextricably linked with my position as a mother. Like,
absolutely.
Different, like, I care about the same things in different ways, I guess is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, and I mean, the intersection of those things literally lies in our bodies. You know, the same body that bears your child or breastfeeds on your break is the same body that goes to work and, you know, and does your shift. And so I don't think that women are unaware of the ways in which our wage labor and our unwaged labor kind of intersect. I think that we are sometimes unaware of the power that we have to leverage our waged labor to make gains for us as unwaged laborers.
Yeah, for sure. And I think that organizers forget that. Like, I think that it's kind of like, oh, you know, especially organizers who are young and don't have kids, like, it's sort of like people with families, it's just like, oh my God, that's so complicated, you know, and I can't possibly think about how our organizing could, you know, have an impact. And to me, it's like, yeah, I mean, we have to fight even even more, right? For stuff that, you know, it's basic, right? Like sick time is huge, right? Like my husband has only, I mean, he's a teacher. Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, he has like a lot of, I mean, he's in also in kind of the field of waged reproductive labor, but he's only got 3 family medical days a year. Like we used those up by like November, right?
Yeah,
so
totally.
It's like for me, sick time is like a massive demand, like for families, you know, sick time that where you don't have to produce a doctor's note or where it can be flexibly applied to kids. It's not you that has to be sick. Like I know lots of places that have, oh, well, you know, you're sick, but it doesn't, you know, if your kid is sick, well, that's not the same thing. You know,
there's the kind of theory of the patriarchal wage in the sense that wages have historically been given to men for their labor and not to women for their labor. And so I think that unions in some senses, especially in traditional unions, but even to some degree in the IWW and in other union contexts, because we're all socialized in the same world, we think of the patriarchal wage when we're organizing, that's the wage that we have in mind. And so we're very focused on bread and butter, traditional issues that we think unions might have taken on 50, 75 years ago. And we don't look at how can we make different kinds of demands and how can we build power for people who were traditionally left out of those conversations and expand our conversations to include their issues, their concerns, and their particular relationships to their work.
Yeah, for sure. So do you want to explain a little bit more about patriarchy of the wage? Like,
I don't actually know that much about it. I don't have really that much more to add to it. It's basically just the idea that wages in themselves are conceived of as or in their inception were patriarchal by nature, that when we trade our work for our conditions of existence under capitalism, that we receive a wage for that. And that was typically men. Women traded their unwaged labor, you know, looking beautiful, getting married, having babies, keeping households clean, for the conditions of their existence, i.e. living in the house of a man who made a wage. So men were mediating that relationship between women and capital.
I see. Right. So now, yeah,
that's changed.
But so, I mean, we need to make, in some ways, it's kind of, that's where I'm trying to get to, is we need to make direct demands of employers for, you know, reproductive labor issues, like to improve the conditions of our existence, right?
For sure.
To improve the conditions under which we perform these, you know, the kinds of reproductive labor that are never going to go away.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and that's one of the definition pieces of reproductive labor, is that it doesn't go away.
It's just
because it's repetitive.
Like, it's being human.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. It's our lives, our actual lives as workers.
And it's the what's so weird about capitalism is that it separates that, you know, it's that somehow it not only makes it, you know, it cleaves off, you know, wage labor and separates reproductive labor as like this thing that is, you know, not only separate, but also devalued.
And yet we constantly see the concessions that capitalism has to make towards the idea that reproductive labor does actually have a dollar sign value attached to it. And we see that through social assistance payments that families get. And we see that through the fact that we have a child welfare system. And I always point to this one as a really good example of the fact that we don't actually believe that childcare is an unskilled job. Because if it was unskilled and we just let anybody do it, we wouldn't have people who stepped in when we didn't believe that people had enough skills to care for their children.
Yeah. As flawed as
as flawed as that system is.
Yeah.
But as a society, there are these moments where you can kind of look through the fabric and see that there are these little holes where capitalism actually says, but we do have to give you this little piece so that you can continue doing the work that you're doing, because the whole machine does not run if there is not reproductive labor rolling underneath it to keep things moving.
Yeah. Well, and it's like, again, it's like this whole discounting unions as, like, you know, institutions of the past, like, but then still, you know, wanting to push for things like universal childcare. Like, unions are the perfect, you know, bodies to be pushing for that, right? Like, if enough workers were winning demands related to childcare responsibilities, whether they're winning, you know, in-house childcare on site, whether they're winning, you know, more flexible sick days, that, like, anything that is related, you know, if that was a big enough, you know, thing that was happening in the marketplace, you better believe that employers would be putting an effective lobby on government to start picking up some of the slack.
For sure they would be. Yeah. And not just picking up the slack, but picking up the bill.
Yeah.
For that, which is part of the,
exactly,
you know, which is part of the whole concession to the fact that it actually has, you know, a monetary value.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I completely agree with you on
that. Yeah, so, I mean, it's kind of this, so, I mean, it's, we started off sort of talking about, like, the terrain of struggle for reproductive labor. You know, it definitely, the state is a part of that, for sure. But we can't let employers off the hook either, right? Like, we have to be thinking about our organizing in this holistic way. We can't think about, like, that a wage is just, you know, for millennials, you can afford the next, you know, more expensive avocado toast. I mean, to throw out a ridiculous stereotype, but, like, these are not, what are the things that people are actually spending their money on? You know, bread and butter, like, to think about, like, I just think it doesn't make any sense to be sort of at all dismissive of bread and butter issues, you know, or even to think that they're somehow totally separate from, you know, other kinds of repression and exploitation.
I don't think, yeah, there's a couple of things I want to pick up on in there. I definitely don't think that they are separate from other kinds of oppression and exploitation. I do want to make the point that because women perform, and I'm going to use women broadly and I'm going to use motivations broadly, because many women perform reproductive labor out of concern and care and emotional attachments to the people in their lives, we can't only focus on bread and butter issues when we are organizing with those particular folks, because the reasons they're doing that work might be very rooted in how they feel about the people around them. And so if we leave that out and we say, well, ignore how you feel about this work, did you know you could get a dollar an hour raise? That's got to be a great motivation for you to organize, right? And for you to put your job on the line. That's where I think a lot of union organizing falls down, because we're not saying, well, why is it that you do come to work every day? Oh, you're coming to work because you really care about making sure that your kids get an education. You know, let's talk about ways that we can fight for, you know, this within your workplace. And so I do think it's important when we look at bread and butter issues that we are not trampling over top of people's lived experience of their work to tell them that the things they care about are the traditional issues that unions have taken on, like wages and hours and that kind of stuff. So there's that.
For sure. And, like, that's not, I was just sort of responding to the, like, any being dismissive of it, because it sort of forgets that you know, there's, it's sort of somehow completely separate. But absolutely, I mean, that would be bad organizing, right?
Mm-hmm. Like, it is bad organizing, but people do it.
Oh, yeah.
All the time. And I see it more within, like, a business union context, but I also see it a lot even within the IWW, because I think that one place that our IWW training could do a lot better is to include examples that fall outside that traditional category of things that unions work on, so that we could talk about some of those other reasons why people organize. So for example, a lactation room would be a great example to include in, you know, training materials, is talking about, okay, well, it's really important to you that you be able to breastfeed your baby at work and that you can take a break to do that.
Yeah.
So I forget what the other thing I was going to say about that was. No, I completely forgot. So I just wanted to let you know that I forgot so we don't have to go back to it.
Well, yeah, I mean, we can stay here for like that. That's, I agree. I mean, and I think it's sort of when we talk about AEIOU and we talk about having organizing conversations, I mean, I think it there's this sort of learning curve, right? Where it's like, and for everybody, it's just so different for the individual organizer, right? I mean, there's this learning curve where you're sort of identifying your own, you know, assumptions, that come from your own experiences and background and, you know, and so you really, like, I think really the process of becoming a good organizer, and I don't think, you know, I'm even there, you know, I think it's sort of something you can never be, you know,
good enough at.
You can always be better, but like, is mostly an, you know, a process of learning how to listen, you know, carefully and really kind of setting aside those assumptions and you know and so yeah, I guess that's kind of, it's all absolutely like we need to be, you know, in the training we talk about, like, it's not about what's going on, it's about what's really going on, right? And kind of training yourself to listen for those things, and I agree, it's not easy to do, you know, especially if you're, you know, and I think a big part of organizing is talking to people who are very different from you, or should be, if you're only talking and organizing to people who are similar to you demographically, then you've got a problem.
But we're all raised in a society, a patriarchal society, and also a society that has very clear historical conversations about what is labor, what is not labor, and you know, what should be important to working people and what is kind of outside that realm. And we need to be really conscious of expanding those conversations to be bigger because we are born with the blinders on. And I think that even when people are talking about, even when people are talking about their own issues at work, they are already self-censoring for you, thinking this fits under the category of things that I'm allowed to talk about as issues in my workplace, and this is just my own problem that I have at home. And so there's a kind of a self-censorship piece that means that our conversations are limited, and that failure of imagination as organizers can take our ability away from us to address those issues directly. And so I think that we really need to make sure that we are also opening doors for people where they might not be opening them themselves. But can we make that conversation consciously wider? I think I remembered what I was going to say earlier, which is that in that waged, unwaged intersection, we're also seeing a lot of really dodgy iterations of capitalism. So for a lot of my families that I work with, we're seeing MLMs, multi-level marketing.
Oh, yeah.
So like
pyramid schemes.
pyramid schemes. Yeah. But there's kind of legal issues attached to using that term pyramid scheme. So they call them MLMs now, but I see lots of my families believe they are working in a waged context when in fact they are working in an unwaged context. Because we have done a very good job of telling people what work looks like. And so the fact that the wage is not there still doesn't stop women from believing that they are working in a waged situation, because we build things that look like workplaces and look like work and then tell them that they're working. And on the far side of that, there's no money coming in, and it's not, there isn't, and in fact, often there's money going out the door. Examples of this include like Scentsy, and there's, I'm probably going to get sued for saying this. Scentsy, there's like a bag company that they do.
Yeah, I mean, there's makeup, there's
oils, essential oils, and we're also seeing it
health
in other ways. We're seeing it in like, you know, gig economy and that kind of stuff. stuff, where which is a little bit more
precarity, right? Like broad, really just casting a much broader net, right? Like that the way that our waged, you know, like the terrain of struggle for waged work, right? It's like when we're thinking about organizing within waged work, we also have to cast that wide net and expand our imaginations.
For sure.
Right? Like we have to be able to organize effectively in contexts that aren't, you know, a full-time job.
Exactly.
Like, with a pension. Like, we need to, and I mean, it's going to be difficult.
And there are no shortcuts. I mean, I think things like Target are especially difficult to pin down in the context of, like, you are technically employed by a pyramid scheme. And so the terrain for us is constantly changing. And one of the reasons that it can change so effectively is because we have lots of really great societal stories about how women do work and the ways that that work should be valued.
Mm-hmm. So I have a question from someone else.
Uh-oh.
Do you think it is possible to organize or reorganize reproductive labor so that it ceases to be a source of women's marginalization?
Yes.
And how does that look?
The first part was easy. The second part is not easy. I can tell you how some component pieces that I think are important to that. First of all, I think it must be a large, widespread, mass scale kind of thing. Not to say that you cannot have individual struggles in individual workplaces and individual communities, but I think we need a lot of people pushing towards the same kinds of goals. I think we need very clear demands. I think we need to know what it is we're trying to get so that we can know when we got it. And also when we've been put off and sent down, you know, a rabbit hole towards something else.
Mm-hmm.
I think that we also need to continually, as individuals, point out the devaluation of women's labor. I know that that sounds like kind of an activist-y strategy. I think it's just good practice on a personal level. We need to say, wait a minute, no. That woman is working. She's working at her home. She's working with her 6 kids that she's taking care of, you know, because that's not what's happening. We've got, you know, welfare queens as kind of a thing that's going on in society, or people who we're talking about, Instagram influencers and people who are selling their lifestyle online. And we look at that and we say, well, she's not working.
Mm-hmm.
She is working. She's hustling hard to get there. And so when we see people devaluing women's labor in whatever form it exists, we have to point that out and say, wait a minute, no, that's not what's going on here. And so to just continue the education of our fellow workers, especially as women, where we see the different manifestations of our work more clearly than anybody else does, we can point those things out to other people who are maybe blinded to it. What was the question again? The question was, how does that happen?
Okay. Well, the follow-up then is, so no, not necessarily. I mean, I think that, yeah, I mean, is it possible? You know, I think really like laying out a step-by-step. I mean, what you said first was like, it needs to be big and it needs to, you know, we're a long way away. We need massive, you know, social movements. We need a lot more organizing that's going on right now. But it's not something that's sort of inherent, you know, like it's not, it is constructed, like the exploitative, you know, the way that reproductive labor marginalizes women is a function of capitalism. It's not inherent to the type of labor that it is, or inherent to anything about being a woman.
No. And one of my favorite quotes of all time is from Silvia Federici, who says that the basis of sexism and racism lies in the construction of work. And so not that different people like different work, or that different kinds of work exist in the world, but the narratives that we use to obscure exploitative relationships, that's the problem. And so I really like that quote because I think it gets to the bottom line, which is that we construct work in very particular ways. And so we also have to deconstruct that work and look at the truth of that labor if we're going to make strides.
Right. So I guess part of it would be about kind of, and when you're saying pointing out whenever it happens, you know, the devaluing of women's labor, I mean, that's the sort of more immediate, you know, how do we get there about like just shifting the way that we value it mm-hmm. in the first place, right?
Yeah.
Like it is devalued. And so, you know, but we need to get to the point where it is valued because like we said before, like it's just being human. Like these mm-hmm. things are necessary to function as society.
And
in some form, I mean, there's lots of ways to organize, you know, or to, you know, for reproductive labor to happen, mm-hmm. but yeah.
But also because people, the other kind of goal of pointing that out is not just to educate people around us, but also to ensure that we are building confidence and power in people. When people are systematically over centuries devalued and made to feel like their work is meaningless, it takes a toll on our ability to say, you know what, actually, my work does have a value and I am not lazy because I stay home with my two kids. I am working really hard to do this job.
It was when I went back to work after my second maternity leave, I was like, this is so much easier.
Well, and I'm constantly amazed. Like I don't have children, but I, you know, raise kids all day long and I do potty training and I do feeding and I do dressing and all that kind of stuff. And I often think about what my life would be like if I had to go home at the end of the night to a child.
Yeah.
I couldn't do it. I think that I would probably have to change professions because the child that I would be going home to at the end of the night would get what's left of me, which is not a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And so it is really, really difficult to work with kids. It's difficult to do that reproductive labor. And so we need to make sure that we are saying that and we are lifting up our sisters by pointing that out and not letting other people say, you know what, it actually just doesn't count for a lot. And you know, my grandmother, she never complained a day in her life and she had 10 children and women these days. I've decided I'm starting my own podcast. I was in the Starbucks on the way here, and there was some guy standing in front of a piece of art. And I mean, nobody's supposed to like Starbucks art, are they? It's not supposed to be like widely, you know, known as great art. And this guy was talking about how terrible this piece of art was on the wall, which was of a, you know, sort of tasteful nude covered by flowers. And he said, you know what? He's like, Feminism's the reason that this art is so bad. And I've decided that I am going to start my own podcast and it's just going to be called For Which We Blame Feminism. Not actually, I'm not doing a podcast, but
yeah, it's, well, I mean, feminism, that's can be blamed for a lot of things. And it is like, I don't remember. My husband was telling me a similar sort of story that was like, kids in his school, right, saying like, you know, just clearly, you know, mimicking their parents about like,
mm-hmm.
well, that's, you know,
yeah,
you know, well, men, blah, 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 feminism's to blame.
Yeah, totally.
So I don't want to open up too big of a can of worms, but you sort of said something there that is, you know, another kind of topic and term that I sort of want to pick apart because I think there is some overlap and I don't really understand the overlap entirely, but you know,
I probably don't either.
You talked about like, you know, being at work all day and you know, doing reproductive labor and then like the thought of coming home to it. I want to talk about emotional labor, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like as it's specific, like I understand it's kind of this term that sort of has taken on a life of its own and sort of a lot of people use it to just kind of say, you know, to refer to any time that sort of you have to talk about talk about feelings, but like where your feelings are involved. So, but I'm thinking about it as like the way that it really is defined, which is, you know, managing your emotions in the context of a wage.
Yeah.
You know, to perform your job. So, so I mean, there's, and I think that probably, when you're doing reproductive labor in a waged context, I would imagine that the quotient of sort of emotional labor would be maybe a little bit or a lot higher, right? I mean, you're a teacher. My husband's a teacher. Like, he's like emotionally exhausted at the end of the day in a way that I'm not, because I'm on a computer all day, right? But he's like dealing with kids and their emotions, and they're just like, it's a lot.
Yeah. I think that the emotional labor that I do at my job is the primary component of my job, especially because I work with behaviorally challenging children. Sorry, I should reframe that, children with behavioral challenges. And in that context, I was joking actually with Marianne, who wrote in the question, about how I pretend that all of my emotions exist on a spectrum from like delighted to mildly surprised. That's it. Like, I don't have anything outside that. And I take all the rest of it and I just like shove it down somewhere else and deal with it later, because it is very possible to be extremely frustrated with a child, angry with a child, or, you know, just absolutely devastated and feel broken down and like you want to cry. So all of those things are possible. I just pretend they're not, for the benefit of my children in my classroom and in their homes. And so I am doing emotional labor. Emotional labor is the biggest piece of my job. But I push back societally against the widening use of the term emotional labor to describe anything that we do to get through our day and interact with other people, because I don't think it's being used in the way that it was intended to be used. And I'm not saying that terms can't change and that we can't apply things in new ways, but I don't think it benefits us as a class to frame everything that we do with a kind of a capitalist mindset to it.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think that it's hard to kind of pick it apart, right? Because if someone, you know, like teachers, you know, are spending their waged labor, and which is, you know, most of the time of your sort of waking hours doing this really intense kind of emotional labor, the ramifications for the home is that there's less capacity, right? Mm-hmm. Like that it's harder to come home and deal with a 3-year-old tantrum after you've been dealing with 10-year-olds tantruming, you know,
exactly,
all day. But, you know, but I think that again, it's this kind of, you know, but I guess, you know, you're saying like you push back, and I agree, like this, when we sort of like, oh, you know, we're doing emotional labor when we sort of like when my partner comes home and he is, you know, dealing with our children, he's no longer doing emotional labor.
Right.
you know, he's doing emotional labor at his wage job.
Exactly.
But I, you know, it's the, I guess the intersection, or one of the intersections, is that, like I said, like there's, it's something that when you're doing reproductive labor in a waged context, is the chances that you're doing a lot of emotional labor while you're doing it are much higher. And there's also this sense that it's somehow natural or inherent to being a woman, right? Like you know, I mean, to give more examples of what we mean by the kind of emotional labor in a waged context, I mean, you know, you could say that there's something kind of inherently good and valuable about the kind of emotional labor you're doing, but emotional labor is also, you know, being nice to an asshole customer.
Exactly. Yeah.
You know, in
to
any
get your
kind
tip
of
or
to get a tip, or just to not lose your job, right? That's emotional labor, because you have to sort of manage your emotion. You have to smile, you know, you might flirt to get a tip. You might, you know, just sort of not tell someone to go where they should be told to go.
Yeah.
Because that's, you're at work, right? And you have to, you're in a context where you have,
no, that's exactly right.
Right. Like you have your power is limited in how you're, but the, you know, I think the expectations that you think that the places where you see a lot more emotional labor being, you know, conducted are also those, you know, tend to be in fields that are, now this is completely, I am not speaking off the cuff, but I wouldn't be surprised if there's those fields are, you know, are more heavily dominated by women, right? Or at least are sort of like have this perception of being,
or the expectation is simply higher, because I've been in a lot of workplaces where men are allowed to lose their temper because they're men. But as a woman, if you lose your temper, then you're volatile and you're emotional and hysterical on the job, and you might lose your job over it. So we just give men a lot more latitude for not a whole range of feelings, but specifically anger, which we experience a lot in a workplace context, and say, you know what, well, that's just kind of because he's a man. I see it constantly in teaching, where we see men who have outsized reactions to challenging behavior from children, perceived as being really firm, authoritative disciplinarians, but women who have outsized reactions to challenging behavior are perceived as not being professional enough to continue their work. I have seen men certified as teachers who exhibited that kind of emotional volatility, and women completely denied certification based on it. So I would definitely say we give men a lot more latitude for that, if nothing else. But I also like to differentiate between who benefits from particular types of emotional labor. So, you know, if I'm suppressing my feelings at work because I have to deliver some dinner to a table and somebody's being mean to me and I need to keep my job, my boss benefits from that. People might return to that restaurant because they got, you know, great service, even though they were a real jerk. And my boss benefits from it. When I go home at the end of the night and I don't yell at my kid because I crumpled up those feelings and put them somewhere else, capitalism doesn't care. They don't care whether or not you yelled at your kid or not. As you know, reproductive labor cares that there is a kid, that there will be a worker. That's that has some value.
Yeah, that can kind of function in
totally,
some way.
Exactly. But largely, nobody cares whether you yelled at your child or not. That's an act of love that we don't, when we don't, that it's, you know, that's something that we did for the benefit of our children and our families. It's not for the benefit of capitalism that we didn't choose that strategy over another one.
Well, and again, kind of pulling this back to kind of our agitate conversations, right? Like that, you know, for me, one of the biggest implications of emotional labor on organizing is really kind of, you know, following those threads in our organizing conversations where we, you know, when we have to listen when somebody says something like, I'm so exhausted at the end of the day, like an emotion, they might be meaning emotionally exhausted that I, you know, I lose my temper with my kids, right? Mm-hmm. Like I don't have enough energy, you know, I'm stressed, I'm whatever it is. Like, for me, you know, that, you know, having to perform a lot of emotional labor, I mean, maybe I'm just, I don't have the same capacity for it as you do, but like, yeah. It's, you know, if I have to deal with difficult people, you know, it's harder for me to have, you know, I'll often then end up, and I mean, then it just is kind of this runaway train, right? Where it's then, you know, you bring home this energy and then it's nasty. And I mean, there's a whole bunch of different ways it can manifest, but I think as organizers, we really need to sort of train ourselves to listen to those kinds of things, like the way that the sort of what's being required of us at work, not like just in this actual physical or mental tasks, but also the emotional component of what's being required of us at work, how that's impacting the rest of our lives.
And not just for the sake of being supportive of our fellow worker, but because that literally might be somebody's motivation to organize.
Exactly.
Maybe I don't care. Maybe I'm making a pretty good wage and my benefits are all right and my hours are fine. But the fact that I go home and I lose it with my kid is heartbreaking to me because that is a high emotional content issue. Mm-hmm. That might be my reason, is I don't want to have to take that home with me at the end of the night. It's not fair to my child. And so as organizers, that I think that's part of that broadening conversation at looking at how we take individual issues and turn them into motivations and reasons to continue that work.
Yeah. I think that's a good place to stop, because I mean, it's kind of where we keep ending up, right? Mm-hmm. Like, and I think that it's something that, you know, I see, you know, we see a lot as trainers, like going in and kind of people kind of coming to terms with, organizing for the first time. Right. And often, you know, it's really nice when we get to see people coming back, you know, I mean, or, you know, developing over time and actually starting to organize or just think about this stuff in a different way. And like coming back to a second organizer training and to kind of see how they've shifted. And I think for me, that's one of the biggest kind of, like I said, the learning curves, right. Is mm-hmm. that, you know, those skills that are just really about paying attention and having, and really what you said, kind of expanding our imagination, expanding kind of what's on our radar, what's sort mm-hmm. of going to set off our spidey senses that there's something there that's going to be, you know, that could be the hook for someone to get, you know, to eventually take some risks, right? To make some demands, because it is at the end of the day, that's what it's going to take, right? Like when we're looking for those, you know, the things that make our, you know, that are motivating for our coworkers or in the context of unwaged reproductive labor, the, you know, our neighbors or, you know, other parents in similar situations, like the people that we should be organizing with in these kind of whatever forms it takes, right? We need to kind of come at it, you know, with this kind of understanding, you know, or an attempt to understand those people as whole people, mm-hmm. right? And not that you can ever fully understand, you know, one person, you know, but like just really trying to take those blinders off, you know, one at a time. There's more than one. You just kind mm-hmm. of, I think the process of becoming an organizer is just kind of taking off blinder after blinder after blinder.
And looking at the ways, like I believe in women. We have for centuries been organizing ourselves, including to do things like manage our own reproductive labor outside work. We've been getting together and having, you know, groups where women will take the, you know, all the children for one afternoon so that other women can go home and clean their houses. And we have been organizing for our own benefit for a very long time. And we are very smart about the ways that we do this work. And so if we allow those conversations to get bigger, our imagination as organizers is going to grow. And I think we are fully able to solve problems like how do we organize reproductive labor and how do we make change on a mass scale that benefits people who are doing unwaged labor everywhere.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. Well, I think maybe let's leave it there. Thank you so much. I've really enjoyed this conversation. I hope other people will too.
Me too. Thank you very much for having me.
Well, thank you. All right. Well, that was the Wobcast with Katya. And until next time, solidarity forever, fellow workers.